Thank you for listening to Issues Etc., and thanks to all of you who have chipped in to help support the show. Listener contributions are the reason we can do this, so thanks.
Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. When you go to your church on Sunday morning, you often think of it as a safe haven from the secularized culture. But has the secularization of the culture found its way into the church? Is the culture, secularized as it is, calling the shots for your church on Sunday morning? Tonight on Issues Etc., we talk about the secularization of the church. It comes in many forms and in forms that you may not readily recognize. Hopefully after tonight's conversation, you will recognize if your church has been secularized or not. Tonight we're going to be talking about the secularization of the church, and we're joined by Dr. Mike Horton. He's professor of apologetics and systematic theology at Westminster Seminary in Escondido, California. He's co-host of the national radio program called The White Horse Inn, and he's author of numerous books, including his latest called God of Promise. Mike, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be with you.
Do you think that many American evangelicals have a double standard? While they readily recognize the secularization that's going on in the culture around them, they fail to see the secularization of their own churches. They see something like Judge Roy Moore, and they're ready to go to war when the Ten Commandments are taken out of a public civil building. But when their own pastor fails to even mention those commandments for Sunday after Sunday, or the answer to those commands, accusations in the cross of Jesus Christ Sunday after Sunday, they fail to notice that.
Yeah, it's not, you know, the thing that's insidious about it, it seems to me, Todd, is that it's not an explicit double standard. I guess most double standards aren't, anyway. It's largely because we live and breathe in a culture of marketing, a culture that seeks to conform us and press us into its own mold. And unless we actively, as ministers and as lay people, seek to understand what we believe and why we believe it, we will be conformed to the pattern of this world's way of thinking. That's what Paul says in Romans 12. In view of the mercies of God, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your rightful service, no longer being conformed to this pattern, to the world's pattern of thinking, but being transformed by the renewing of your mind. And that is theology, and that needs to happen on a regular basis. But when the church begins to assume we know all this stuff and thinks what we really need is practical stuff, then we just start going with the flow, even if we're not explicit about it, and we become secularized while we think that we are morally superior.
So go into that a little deeper. Why don't these evangelicals notice that their own churches, their own pulpits, their own Sunday mornings are being secularized?
Well, again, because I think a lot of it is that there's this huge assumption that the culture is neutral when it comes to technology, when it comes to the forms in which culture is delivered to us, when it comes to the form of pop culture, for example, we can very clearly, distinctly see decadence in a strip club. We can spot decadence in so-called gay unions. What we can't spot is the decadence, not only in our own hearts, but the decadence that is part and parcel of putting the Christian faith in such a fragile knapsack as popular culture that cannot hold that treasure or pass it down to future generations. And so it frays, it breaks, and we lose the treasure bit by bit as we're walking along. what we really need is not only the content of the gospel, but the forms that Christ has given his church for carrying it.
Christians, American Christians of the not-too-distant past, Mike, were wary of culture, were wary of all of the things that culture offered by way of improving the church. I think they realized that, I don't know if they would have used the term marketing, but marketing or psychology or architecture or technology, I think they realized that they were not neutral. Mm-hmm. When did the mind, the Christian mind, change on this, that suddenly now all of these things so common in the culture are considered to be theologically neutral?
Well, it's really funny when you look back at, for instance, the fundamentalists. The irony there is that even early on, fundamentalism developed this incredibly worldly attachment to technology, to the entertainment model of revivalism. The music was right out of vaudeville. Fundamentalism has always had this sort of love-hate relationship to the world, whereas Reformation Christianity, I think, certainly not without its own capitulations to cultural compromise, nevertheless has a more, it takes culture a little bit more seriously in both senses, both positively and negatively. Realizing that culture is a gift of God, Reformation churches have nevertheless recognized how prone human beings are to being misled, and therefore how important it is that we're guided by Scripture. And so fundamentalism has always had this kind of naive view that unless the culture expresses itself in dirty movies, dirty words, dirty pictures, and so forth, the cultural forms that we find out there are just the blessing of our time and place, and we ought to use them no matter what. That's a kind of naive worldliness, even while thinking that you're avoiding worldliness in its more overt forms.
Let's talk about some Sunday mornings. Specifics when it comes to the secularization of the church, Mike, beginning with what is preached in many evangelical churches on Sunday morning. Where do you see it?
Well, you know, this is a very difficult thing for one pastor to do, criticize the ministry of other ministers. But I look out there, Todd, and I know, you know, this is what I hear everywhere I go. I'm sure you do, too. I hear the same message from people, and it's the same message that I hear myself, namely, that where has the preaching of Christ gone? Sometimes, even I see it in our own graduates. Sometimes we will, you know, we harp at our seminary, as I know you do at the Concordias. We harp here on Christ-centered, redemptive, historical preaching, preaching Christ from Genesis to Revelation. But, you know, a minister gets out there in the field and starts reading the practical how-to books and starts having some meetings with the elders and talks with grandma who is worried that her kids aren't coming to church anymore. And they start to think that that legacy that was passed on to them in seminary, if they even got it in seminary, is not worth preserving. It's not worth holding on to. It's not worth passing on. And so the kind of preaching we often get is, yeah, 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 we know that. We have our confessions locked up in a safety box. We know we can always go back to them if there's a heresy trial. We're not going to let people color outside the lines. But what's actually done is the gospel of assumption, that is, assuming Christ has done all of that, and you already know that, now I'm going to talk about the practical side of life. And that is always to talk about law rather than gospel. Now, the Bible talks about law as well as gospel. The Bible makes applications. The Bible teaches us how to live godly lives. But I'm talking here about the kind of preaching that, first of all, assumes that we don't really need the gospel week after week. We don't really need Christ placarded before us in his saving office week after week. What we really need, now that we're saved, what we really need is to learn how to raise positive kids in a negative world, and how to clean up our marriages, and how to be nicer to each other, and so forth.
Let's talk about this on the other side of the break, more specific on preaching in the secularized church. The late Dr. Robert Preuss was famous for saying, and he often said it in a great time of need in my church, the gospel assumed is the gospel denied. If your pastor steps into the pulpit and he assumes you know the gospel, he assumes you know it and believe it, and therefore don't really need to hear it today, that is an implicit denial of the gospel. We'll talk more about the secularization of the church with Dr. Mike Horton after this.
You know that we love our on-demand listeners, and that's why we've produced this Issues Etc. Classic. Now, if you appreciate this special broadcast, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support during the challenging summer months.
Dr. Mike Horton is our guest. We're talking about the secularization of the church. Before the break, Mike, you talked about how the gospel is assumed in many evangelical pulpits, and then what substitutes for it is, and must by default be, only the law, the demands of God. But is this kind of substitution of law for the atoning work of Jesus Christ in the pulpit, is it really even proper preaching of God's law?
Well, answering that question to a Lutheran is a little presumptuous, but absolutely, we are not rightly dividing the word of truth. Both of our traditions maintain this. Evangelicalism does not. I mean, evangelicalism has historically not distinguished law and gospel in this way. What we're doing here is not saying that the law is unimportant, or that the law shouldn't be preached, or that the law shouldn't be preached also as a guide to the Christian. What we're saying is that the law always has to be distinguished from the gospel, because our nature is to always turn the gospel into law. And that's what we're seeing in our pulpits, even in, I would submit, confessional Reformation churches. We're seeing ministers get up week after week, in many instances, and preach on how Jesus helps us with our daily chores. And it's not really law preaching in the sense of driving us to really see the holiness, the depth of the holiness and righteousness and justice and greatness and majesty of God that sends us fleeing to Christ. It's a preaching of the law that never really takes us out of ourselves, but just drives us deeper into ourselves, so that the gospel has to go that much deeper into the crust of our self-centeredness to reach us. The whole point of the law, first and foremost there, is to break up that crust so that the gospel can get to it, to make us completely despair of being good parents, of being good husbands and wives, of being good workers, of being good friends, so that we will look outside of ourselves to one who is the friend of sinners, who is the husband of his church, who is the Lord and Redeemer of his people.
I just heard a fellow pastor say a couple of weeks ago in an unrelated conversation, Mike, he said, the law never affirms us. It always accuses, but we should also say it never affirms us. It strikes me a lot of the kind of psychologized law that we're hearing in the secularized Christian pulpit is affirmational law. It's there to tell you, here's what you should do, and guess what? You can do it. Mm-hmm. Is that what God's law says to the Christian?
No, what God's law says is, do this and you shall live, not, here, I have some helpful hints for you. No, exactly. It's a kinder, gentler law preaching that we have today than we had in the old fire, hellfire and brimstone days of fundamentalism. You know, we had Bishop C. Fitzsimmons Allison, Bishop of South Carolina, now retired, on the White Horse Inn a while back, talking about the yeast of the Sadducees. He says, you know, we often hear about the yeast of the Pharisees, but he says the yeast of the Sadducees basically is liberalism. The Sadducees were those who denied the resurrection, and they were basically the liberals of Jesus' day. And we know the Pharisees, how they undermine justification through self-righteous moralism, but what about the Sadducees? And he says today, liberalism, Protestant liberalism, has undermined justification with its gospel of therapeutic affirmation. And he says it's justification by affirmation. You ask people, what does justification mean? And that they say, well, it means that God accepts us just as we are. Or it means that God affirms us. It's the gospel of acceptance. And as Bishop Allison rightly points out, the gospel is not God accepts you. The gospel is not God loves you anyway. The gospel is God can only love you because you are in Christ, and God himself, at great personal cost, through the blood of his own son, not through some cheap acceptance, but through the costly death of his son, has imputed a righteousness to you that you do not have in yourself. And therefore, it's not because you're lovely or because he just can't get enough of you or because he sees one little spark, at least, of something that interests him. He loves you because he has found something in himself, not because he has found something in you.
We're talking with Dr. Mike Horton of the White Horse Inn about the secularization of the church tonight on Issues, Etc. Would you agree or disagree with David Wells? He was recently on the program, and near the end of a conversation, he said that in this secularized church, unwittingly, we are probably breeding the next generation of Christian liberals right there in the mainstream of many evangelical churches.
No question about it. I think it's a tragic thing that that has to be said, but it seems accurate. And the fact of the matter, Todd, is over and over again, you can see this played out historically. The World Council of Churches was not founded by a bunch of people who are out to undermine the Christian faith. The World Council of Churches was founded as an evangelical missionary movement. Evangelicals got together at some of the early speeches that I've read. It sounds like an inter-varsity conference. It's basically people getting together to say, you know, it's not just about saving souls, it's about caring for bodies, and we need to transform the culture through the message of Jesus Christ, and we need to spread this world through preaching, but also through social activism. And it's just right out of the history of American evangelical missions and revivals, and yet right there, even at the beginning, they said, let's set aside doctrinal differences. Doctrine divides. Let's come together around our common experience of being born again. And then eventually, of course, that common experience of being born again was set aside, and the World Council of Churches adopted the slogan, theology divides, service unites. And now you have Rick Warren out there saying, we need a new reformation. The first reformation was about doctrine. The new reformation that's coming now is about obedience, is about morality, and about service. And he calls this deeds, not creeds.
Like what you hear? Please support this worldwide outreach with a tax-deductible contribution today.
Dr. Mike Horton is our guest. We're talking about the secularization of the church. Mike, how does the music that is resounding through so many evangelical churches today, how does it sound to you, especially with respect to the increasing secularization of the Christian church?
Well, there again, both in form and content, there is definitely a secularization going on. We often underestimate, and this is probably truer in Reformed circles than it is in Lutheran circles, but we often underestimate the power of music. And so music is just sort of something that we do. Hymns and psalms are just something that we sing. We have a tradition in Reformed churches of singing the Psalter, singing through the Psalms of David. And that, you don't have to worry about being secularized. The Arians, who deny the deity of Christ, got their goods moved all around the ancient world through the singing of ditties. And little children would memorize these heretical ditties, and that's how the heresy was communicated and spread. Similarly, in our day, again and again, even in churches sometimes where I preach or speak at conferences, you'll hear praise choruses, and at a certain point where you've sort of mustered the energy to sing it, overlooking the style, you have to abruptly come to a standstill because you're about to sing something that just isn't true. And previous generations of hymn writers would have known that it's not true. But today, all you need is a guitar and a few chords, and you can become a Christian songwriter. And what's really remarkable is how many of the contemporary Christian music companies are actually owned as wholly owned subsidiaries by international corporations. For instance, Integrity Music in Nashville, Tennessee, from which we get a lot of our praise choruses in evangelicalism, is owned by Seagram's. Now, most singers of the songs published by Integrity Music would not allow consumption of alcohol, especially after the last Southern Baptist Convention, where they outlawed consumption of alcohol for any who hold office. Nevertheless, the music they sing is produced by a company owned by Seagram's. This is the irony of it all. We live in a culture of marketing, and capitalism may be fine for the movement of products between countries. It may be fine for the sale of Coca-Cola, but capitalism as the economy of the church is disastrous. We are not ruled by the invisible hand of the market. We are ruled by the visible hand of Christ through the ordained ministry of ministers and elders. And that is not taking place now. There used to be a time, Todd, I don't know if you guys had this too, in Presbyterian and Reformed songbooks, it would always say every hymn would have at the bottom, you look at these old Psalter hymnals, at the bottom it says, permitted to be sung by the order of General Assembly, or permitted to be sung by General Synod. And today, you can sing anything you want in church without the permission even of the elders. I think it's scandalous that that basically whole services have been taken over by the youth department or by the youth minister or by a worship leader who doesn't have theological training, and the minister has abdicated except for that 20 minutes that he gets up to say what he wants to say. It's just abysmal, the level of theological knowledge that is at least on display, not only by many pastors, but by elders And one of the qualifications for elders is that they have to be able to teach, and that they themselves know the deep truths of Scripture.
You're talking there about the content of the music you mentioned before, form and content. The doctrinal content of many of these popular praise and worship choruses seems to be suffer from a lack of, and almost a complete lack of substance. Even something as basic as the doctrine of the Trinity misses from many of these popular praise and worship choruses. Talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, you know, J. Gresham Machen in the 1920s wrote a review of the new Presbyterian hymnal that was scathing. He noticed in the 1920s that a lot of the old hymns about the cross and the atonement and propitiation and the justification of the sinner was eliminated, and in its place were put songs like that had never appeared in Reformed and Presbyterian hymnals, such as "In the Garden," "I Come to the Garden Alone," "While the Dew is Still on the Roses," or "You Ask Me How I Know He Lives, He Lives Within My Heart." And today, good grief, we've gone way beyond that, but in the same direction, toward a sentimentalization of the faith that only knows the happy, upbeat mode of emotion. One thing you find throughout the Psalter, that is the Psalms of David, is you've got the peaks and valleys. You have high highs, low lows, and everything in between. I can't imagine today walking into an evangelical megachurch and singing one of the Psalms of Lament. Could you imagine walking in and singing "Where are you? Have you abandoned your promise to be faithful to your people? Why don't you get your hands out of your pockets? It would be better if I were dead." You know, that's the kind of stuff.
It's hard to set that to, a very sophisticated drum kit, the synthesizers, the nicely color-coordinated backup singers, and the electric guitar. I mean, it's just really difficult to match those two.
Well, that's just it. See, when people say that style is neutral, you've got to say, no, actually, it isn't. There may be lots of psalms that you couldn't sing with an organ. But there certainly are lots of psalms that you can't sing with percussion and synthesizer. It's just not the case at all that you have a one-size-fits-all view of instrumentation. And I think we need greater sophistication in this area. We need to listen to musicians, but musicians need to listen to ministers, and ministers and musicians need to be in conversation with each other so that we can have the best, richest music of the church, so that there's a connection between the generations. But then we also need to have the very best and richest content. And that only comes, I think, through a rich conversation. It used to be pastors and theologians were also trained in music. I'm part of that generation that wasn't. I wish I were. I appreciate music. I love music, but I'm not trained in it. And I know there are a lot of pastors out there who find it easy to hand the reins over to a music minister. But I think that every worship service ought to be planned not by a worship committee, but by the elders and the minister. Maybe in the process, ministers and elders who don't have musical training can learn something along the way, too.
Well, we're going to take up that subject of the pastor when we come back from this break. Mike had mentioned that many of them aren't trained in music. Many of them aren't even trained in theology. They're trained in marketing, or they're trained to be ecclesiastical CEOs. How has the role of the pastor changed in the secularized Christian church? We'll talk about that on the other side of this break.
If you appreciate this Issues Etc. Classic, please consider making a tax-deductible donation today. You can make a financial contribution by check, make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of us during the difficult summer months.
10 more minutes in our conversation with Dr. Mike Horton on the secularization of the church. Mike, you've mentioned several times, in kind of a sidelong way, the role of the pastor in the secularized Christian church, but let's focus on that. What new role, not for the better, but what new role has the pastor taken upon himself in the secularized Christian church?
Well, I think, as many have pointed out better than I could, pastors today have increasingly taken on the role or have been expected to bear the role of a coach, a therapist, and a CEO. He is, first of all, a coach. We now have life coaches. I saw standing in the line, checkout line at the supermarket, Britney Spears now has an evangelical life coach. That's what they're, I used to joke that pastors are seen now as life coaches, but I guess now there's actually a vocation of life coach. Soon there will probably be an MA in life coach at the seminaries across America. But that's basically this watered down law that we've been talking about. How I can hold your hand and show you how Jesus really is, he really, 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 really is relevant and really wants to have a personal relationship with you and help you with your daily life. Therapy kind of flows into that. God works for me right now, at least in this period of my life. Well, what happens when he doesn't? Well, you'll have to go to another theology for that. But at least right now, while life is going fairly well, and I just need some tips to help me with my life and my family, church will do nicely. And then the pastor is CEO. I had a friend who was in the ministry, utterly burned out, and he said, "I can mark the day on my calendar, the turning point, when my elders stopped calling my study the pastor's study and started calling it the pastor's office. The pastor today is no longer typically seen as a scholar in prayer and study, which is exactly why the diaconate was set up in the first place, as you recall in Acts 7, so that the apostles could be devoted to preaching, ministry of preaching and prayer. But now your picture is not of your pastor sitting in his study, poring over books, working through the Hebrew and the Greek to prepare his sermon, and catechetical lectures for his students and adults and kids, but more as the sort of the guy running the business. And that's why a lot of the seminary curriculum these days, happily not at our seminary, and I'm sure not at Concordia, but at a lot of evangelical schools, is tilted toward the quote-unquote practical, away from the quote-unquote theoretical, which means theology, tilted away from theology to how you run a business. In this, in this environment, the customer is king. But the problem is Christ didn't come to set up a business with franchises. Jesus came to found a church with himself as the prophet, priest, and king. And he mediates that that prophethood, kingship, and priestly ministry through the humble ministers that he has appointed who bring the word, administer the sacraments, and care for the flock in countless ways. If pastors once upon a time were seen as shepherds of the soul, doctors of the soul, today they are increasingly seen as either manipulators of the soul or as people who have at best service-oriented function in relation to my daily life.
All right, then with 1 minute, let's deal with one area of the church's life that many people overlook, although they're exposed to it virtually every Sunday, the architecture of the church. How has it reflected the secularization of the church?
Well, on one hand, I think we have to be careful not to say, you know, that here is a picture of the ideal church. God gave that one time. It was called the Tabernacle and the Temple. We don't have any earthly copy of the heavenly temple now. Christ is the fulfillment of all of those earthly sketches. At the same time, it's important where we worship. Even though we worship ultimately in the heavenly sanctuary, that takes place week by week on terra firma. And so we walk into a building, and what's the first thing we notice? Well, we walk into a Catholic church, and the first thing we notice is that we're basically spectators. The way the thing is set up, the buildings usually are set up, is to awe a person with a sense of the majesty of transcendence, whether that's the transcendence of God or the transcendence of the church. Sometimes the two sort of run into each other. And also to create a sense of spectacle, that I'm basically part of an audience watching the professionals up there do something. I walk into a Baptist church or a Methodist church, many Methodist churches, from the revival traditions, and there's a big choir up front. And drove by a big church the other day that had a marquee, the Singing Church. So you kind of know what that church is all about or thinks that it's all about. Typically, you would go into a Lutheran and a Reformed church, and however they would differ, namely having a table instead of an altar in Reformed churches, however they would differ, the furniture would be immovable up front and central, and that furniture would be the pulpit, the table slash altar, and the baptismal font. The choir, if it existed at all, would be in the back of the church, and it wouldn't be seen, it would be heard. And all of this changed with revivalism, the extent to which our own Reformation churches have been shaped by broader American revivalism is hugely significant.
Then with only 1 minute, and finally, Mike, you have little kids. I have kids that are a little bit older, but they're still young. In this secularized Christian church, what church is the secularized Christian church leaving to that next generation of Christians? 1 minute.
Yeah, the generation that knew not God nor what he had done for Israel. That's the generation that we're leaving behind. And you know what happened then. We're told every man did what was right in his own eyes. That's what we're seeing today, a culture of consumers. But all across the country and in other parts of the world, you and I are both seeing, Todd, a growing interest, especially of younger people, in something of substance. And so it may be smaller churches rather than mega churches, but they're growing. We see our graduates going out there planting churches, and those churches grow with people from non-Reformed backgrounds, even a lot of non-Christian backgrounds. That's very encouraging. It bodes well for the future, because there are a lot of moribund, dry, dusty, old confessional churches that have taken their heritage for granted, too. And there's nothing more exciting than seeing families joyfully embracing the great truths of the gospel and insisting that that be handed down faithfully to their children, and not only insisting that churches do that, but that they do it in the home.
To find out how to contact our guest in this hour, Dr. Mike Horton and the White Horse Inn, or to help support Issues Etc. by joining our monthly donor program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Dr. Mike Horton is Professor of Apologetics and Systematic Theology at Westminster Seminary in Escondido, California, co-host of The White Horse Inn, and author of numerous books, including his latest, God of Promise. Mike, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd. Always a pleasure.
He spoke there about substance. What is the substance that the church has always possessed and that, God willing, we will continue to leave to our children? The gospel of Jesus Christ, the message for sinners, Christ for sinners at the cross, in his perfect life, his death, and his resurrection. That is the substance that the church, the true church, leaves to a dying world. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.